Welcome back, or welcome to the Single Track Podcast. I'm your host, Finn Melanson, and in this episode, I'm joined by Mary Kate Shea, who serves as the Senior Director of Pro Athletes for Road Race Events through the Boston Athletic Association. Every year, Mary Kate is responsible for recruiting and facilitating the experience of hundreds of pro runners at marquee events like the Boston Marathon, the BAA 10K, and the BAA 5K. Given her wealth of knowledge and experience in the realms of pro athlete recruitment and sponsorship, event management, and sports marketing as a whole, I thought it would be great to have her on the show to consider the merits of her position and how her dedicated year-round full-time role could be implemented more often at individual races, but also at scale in our sport, and sort of wondering how that might benefit our world as a whole. In this conversation, we talk about what it takes to build and maintain a world-class running event and why her role in the process is so pivotal, how pro athletes are researched, recruited, compensated, and generally taken care of at races like the Boston Marathon, and all sorts of lessons and takeaways for interested athletes, operators, and media personnel in the trail world. With that, let's get into it. Mary Kate Shea, it is a pleasure to have you on the Single Track Podcast. How are you doing today?
Great. Thank you for inviting me. This is exciting. I love trail running. Love the ultra scene.
Well, I was just going to say, from what I gather back in the 90s, you pitched a story on Anne Trace into the Boston Globe. And so I guess I say that to say that you already have a lot of interest in our ultra trail running world.
Absolutely. I grew up on the south of Boston and lived away for many years. And when I came back, I joined the Marshfield Roadrunners, and in that group, there was a gentleman by the name of Roger Welch, who just passed away last year. But there was a great ultra group, and he set many 50K American records and all sorts of crazy 24-hour records. So they kind of folded me in and, hey, let's try a 50K. Let's go up to Lake Warmog. Hey, what about the 50-miler in Vermont? Sure, I'll try that. And once you try a 50-miler, and you're able to finish, you're like, I get it. 100 miles is doable. And then they wrote me into a 100-miler. So, but everyone always supported each other, you know, and it's just so freeing. Running an ultra, running in the trails, you're not looking at your watch. There's a great camaraderie. There's a lot of collaboration. I think on my first one, I didn't know you were supposed to have extra salt on a hot day. It was like back in the 90s, we barely knew you had to drink water. And it was enlightening because we all had a subscription to Ultra Running, Don Allison. And you just have to pick up word of mouth, like tips. You just have to talk to people about tips, like what should I be eating and drinking? There was nothing special about it other than it was a challenge, a personal challenge for everybody out there.
Athletes in our sport from the 80s, 90s, I would even say the early aughts, I would always argue are demonstrably tougher and braver than athletes today. There's a lot of the research is still nascent, but the 100-mile distance, 50-mile distance, all that stuff is becoming less and less of a mystery from like a coaching standpoint, nutrition standpoint. It's becoming more actually really about like the dynamics of competition than I would say, you know, rewriting the record books and kind of figuring out what's possible from like a human performance standpoint, which I think is kind of cool. Cause at the end of the day, I would love to see the evolution more towards competition than like, what is a human capable of?
Yeah. Well, I think to me, both are intriguing, right? What is a human capable? What are some fastest known times around the world? What are we capable of? But then that element of competition in the midst of that capability is also intriguing. That's kind of what keeps me really motivated and happy in the job that I've been doing for 25 or so years here with the BAA.
I was telling you this offline, I guess just to cue up a little bit of context for this conversation, a lot of listeners of the show, they're race directors, they're pro athletes, they're marketing people, they're general operators in the sport of trail running, sport of ultra running. And a lot of us, myself included, we're always looking for the next thing or ways to improve the systems in our community. I would say most people are pretty receptive to new ideas. And I don't think the title or the position of elite athlete coordinator is totally novel in our sport, but like there are races like UTMB and I think like Ultra Trail Cape Town. I think even like the Mount Washington Road Race might have one, but I don't think we have someone in our community that is as year-round involved and like focused on this particular aspect of the race experience like you are. And so, you know, one of my hopes is that this can really stand as sort of like an evergreen intro episode to what you do and what you've learned, you know, since the mid-90s, and maybe people can get inspired by it. And, you know, some of these race directors listening, they can be like, well, I can implement that and maybe create some sort of competitive advantage for my own race. So really appreciate it. I just wanted to kind of right off the bat, thank you, because I think this is a really like exciting world that you operate in. It's somewhat new in trail and we have a lot to learn.
Yeah, it is. It's interesting to me. I think the major difference is that, say, in the major marathons in the world, if we just take the Abbott World Marathon Majors, or if we just take Chicago, New York, and Boston, the genesis of that pro field, which for Boston started probably 1986 when John Hancock decided to sponsor it, was that in inviting the best athletes in the world, it wasn't totally selfless. It was, we invite the best athletes in the world. That generates media interest. Media interest results in media value. Media value results in sponsors more attracted to the race. Sponsors bring in the money, which then can support the pro fields. So without it, it goes hand in hand. So they both feed each other. And trail running, A, it's very hard to cover from a media perspective. But when you watch some of those shows about the multiple day treks and North Face sponsors and other entities sponsor, those are fascinating. That's fascinating for not only spectators, but sponsors to, you know, tag along to. And I think trail's getting there, especially with some of the bigger races around the world. And I'm not really familiar with how a recruiter would attract pros to a race that may not be in a competition series or may not be at that top tier. And probably that's where you have to start in the grassroots, is saying, you know, every trail race is important. Who do we have in our race? And even if they're not being recruited or supported financially, who can we tell a story about? How can we get it out there? And that's probably what part of this podcast is doing too, is you're telling these great stories of a lot of phenomenal athletes, but you can't make a living from professional trail running unless you have some type of financial support, because it just takes so much time. It takes a lot of time to train and to be at the top of your sport.
Quick break to thank NAC for supporting the show. NAC is the official nutrition partner of Singletrack, and you've heard me talk a lot about their mission, their products, and why I'm into what they're doing. But one thing I haven't talked a lot about that I'm pretty excited on are their race-specific nutrition quizzes. These exist on their website, and you know, with races like the Black Canyon 100K on the near horizon, you can take these quizzes, enter all your relevant information like height, weight, sweat rate, race day goals, and it formulates a nutrition plan right down to the precise aid stations on each of these courses. It's awesome. Go check it out for yourself at NAC.com. And while you're there, if you end up buying some product, feel free to use code SINGLETRACK15 at checkout for 15% off your next order. Maybe the answer to this question would highlight the importance of your role, but in a hypothetical scenario, if you turned off the faucet of athlete recruitment for the Boston Marathon, how quickly would interest in the race and eagerness to sign up and do it kind of fall by the wayside, and other races in the sport would like really, you know, take advantage of that, and there would just be a totally different environment, you know, 2 or 3 years down the line as a result?
A couple of things would happen. There'd always be a Boston Marathon, I believe.
Yes.
It's going on 128 years. There would always be a Boston Marathon. But it's incredibly expensive to host a Boston Marathon. I think they did a breakout per athlete between the police departments, the fire departments, the 8 cities and towns, the security, especially after the bombing. It's as expensive or not more expensive than the fee we're charging for you to participate in the race. So it is a very expensive race. So you'd have to figure out how do we put that race on with the money we're receiving. If you don't have a pro field, then the media are not interested in covering it. The media pay media rights to cover the race. The highest performing portion of their broadcast is the pro race. They sell commercial spots during the pro race time. They make money, but they also spend money. So most the model is you have to spend money to make money. So if you took the pro race out, I think the Boston Marathon will still be intriguing. But could you really, would the results reverberate? Because now you have no drug testing. You have no oversight by World Athletics or the governing federations. You have no certification from USATF. You have all these rules and regulations and parameters that have been put into place because this pro field is driving the excellence. You have no shoe checks, you know, no sponsor checks. There'd be a lot that would get lost, and I don't know if you could really believe in the results.
When I think about our community, there are some races that are making a concerted effort to be increasingly professionalized and to really prop up and support sort of the competitive aspects of the sport, the professional sides of the sport. There are also just as many, if not more, races out there that are delivering a very different specific experience. It's less about competitive storylines. It's about creating like this grassroots ambiance and showing this particular, you know, area of the country or interesting geography and kind of helping shepherd people through that. And there, obviously there are other reasons to start a race, but I guess where I'm driving with this question is like, is there a specific type of race you want to build when athlete recruitment becomes necessary? Or are there many benefits of building out the programs that you've been building out over the last 25 years?
I think if you want to be a world-class sporting event, then you need to bring in a world-class field. If we're trying to elevate the sport, showcase the sport, spotlight the sport, then it has to require excellence. And the only way to require excellence is to bring in the best athletes in the world. So that's what we're always trying to do, is to have this be not only the Olympics for everyone, because 80% of the field has to qualify to run Boston. So it could be every person's own Olympic challenge to make that qualifying time. But it's also to showcase how amazing the human body is in that motion forward, in that ability to run, in that ability to cover that distance. And that's what I think is so intriguing about our sport. I mean, this past weekend, let's just take that for an example. Agnes Nagetich set a 10K world record, but en route, she set a 5K world record that was just set 2 weeks ago by Beatrice Chebet. So when you look at these performances, and is it shoes, is it training, is it nutrition, what is it? But it continues. When Ilya Kipchoge came to Boston last year, he wanted to take on that challenge of the course. So I agree with you that you can spotlight areas of the world, and have it be a destination trail race. That's very intriguing.
Yeah.
You can't get more spectacular than the scenery surrounding ultra running and trail running. I mean, there's nothing more beautiful than every single trail run I've ever read about, watched, seen. It's just stunning. So definitely that could be capitalized upon. But if you're talking about purely competitive based racing, you're looking to perhaps, you know, some of the comrades or some of the road events, because more people are more apt to cover it from a media standpoint, but also recruitment for those type of events has been ongoing for decades.
So if you were a consultant in our sport and you were starting to pitch or encourage this position at races or within organizations that aren't fully dedicated to it yet, would sort of like your top line statement be, if you want to become a world-class event, part of the journey to that status involves this role?
Yes, I would say so. Because a pro recruiter is someone that is going to research the hell out of everything and everybody involved in that sport. And it's going to go from soup to nuts, as one of my bosses used to say at John Hancock, because I worked for John Hancock before coming over to the BAA. John Hancock was the principal sponsor, and their model was quite intriguing, because as a privately held company in 1986, they said, hey, we're going to provide the money to support this race, but we're going to own the professional field. This is going to be our field. So it was the John Hancock professional athlete field, much like now it's the Bank of America professional athlete field. So in that ownership, there needs to be an expert in that pool who is passionate about the sport, that wants to learn about the sport, but also wants to facilitate bringing together fields that will be intriguing to spectators, fields that will be intriguing to mass participants, fields that will be intriguing to the media. So when you bring in an Ilya Kipchoge like last year, you have to match him up with an Evans Dabet and a Benson Caputo, because you have to make a race. There has to be a race. And that's what's intriguing about a lot of the trail races, because it is dynamic. It's changing continuously. Yes, you have the great trail runners, but positions 3 through 12 are constantly changing. And the effort that's required for that change is what the story is and what's intriguing. So if you were, say, to connect across North America a bunch of smaller races and have a series, they already do series in trail running, but have them connected to share resources, then you could have a pro recruiter who could recruit for a number of different races or shared experiences. Every week we're meeting. Even this morning I met with a group. I also do the pro wheelchair and the pro para for Boston. And we meet with all the major marathons in the world on a regular basis to discuss, hey, what are the top issues right now? What do we need to talk about? Are we talking about equipment? Are we talking about wheelchair technology? What are we doing to lift not only the athletes, but the sport itself? So yes, I think it's definitely a good idea to have some technical experts involved in any type of racing or competitive situation.
You mentioned working for John Hancock before the BAA, and you know, I was trying to think about this before the interview. I would say the biggest race in our sport is called Ultra Trail du Mont Blanc, which is over in Chamonix, France. It's sort of like the Super Bowl of ultra trail running. The presenting sponsor for that race is Dacia, and it would be like it would be like if Dacia was taking charge of all of the athlete recruitment and building these fields, as opposed to people inside of UTMB. And
it was kind of like how I used to explain it. It would be like Dunkin' Donuts setting the lineup for the Patriots game.
Exactly. Yeah. And one of the questions I have there is, if this was under strictly the race's purview, would the approach be the same way, or are there particular interests inside John Hancock that drive the building of these fields in a different direction?
Well, 3 marathons ago, Hancock gave the ownership back to the BAA where it belongs from a obvious standpoint. So now basically I was traded across the street. So now working for the BAA, I'm working within, you know, the BAA is a nonprofit that promotes running, and we have a number of events throughout the year. But working within that model, I've been able to do even more for the sport. And this is how you can do more for the sport. I'll just give you a quick example. So in the old model, I would bring in about 60 athletes, top tier. Everybody would be supported, which means appearance fee, prize awards, lodging, travel, meals, massage, recovery, pickup at Logan, world-class experience for the athletes that we invited here to Boston. With the BAA, what I was able to do is not only bring in those 60, but to merge a sub-elite program, which now I call the professional development program. So what this affords is now to present a group of athletes, which isn't just 25 to 30 of the best men and women. it's 60 of the best men and 60 of the best women, because below that tier of, say, 201 man to the most support will probably stop about 207, 205. Below that, now you have a number of folks who really want to run this race. And then you're allowed to provide other compliments, complimentary entry, transportation to the start, staging at the start, recovery massage, gear check, personal hydration on the course. That's huge, right? So I'm able to extend that so we get increased depth in the field. So it's not just the top athletes, but it's the top 60 athletes, 60 of the world's best. So in the men's field alone, between the Open this year, the Open, the wheelchair, and the para, there's 29 different countries. 29 different countries. It allows you that breadth. So working from inside the industry with the race organizer, you're able to have more flexibility to do increased programmatic elements. So I do like the transition.
One thing I've always been curious about, what are the traits required to be good at this job, and how would you rank order them?
The traits. The traits to be a good recruiter, a good pro athlete recruiter. I look at it like this. So every year, I basically hire 300 people. So I'm hiring 300 professional athletes to run our races around the year, throughout the year. The 5K, the pro mile, the 10K, the half, the marathon. In doing so, you have to be incredibly passionate about the sport. You have to love research. You have to be able to communicate well. You need to provide customer service on a whole different level. Because, I mean, even today, just little emails from a VI, visually impaired athlete, who's a Paralympian. Questions, answering questions timely and in a professional manner. Learning the art of negotiation, which you don't learn in college, but you learn through life experiences. And sorry about that. It's going through my computer, sorry. Okay. So the art of negotiation. So when I first started this back in 1999, the gentleman who was doing the job, I learned an incredible amount from him. He didn't even have a computer. He didn't use a computer. He didn't have email. So it was mostly communicating via phone and messaging and back and forth. And you do really gain some insight in how to work with other people. Say, I wanted you to run Boston, Finn. Yeah. This is how I would go about it. Okay. Finn wants to run Boston. He's approached me, or I've actively sought him out because I've seen him run in Berlin. And I was really excited about how he never gave up, how he competed, how he was a risk taker, how he was gritty and challenging, how he never gave up, how he came through that Brandenburg gate like it was just his first mile. I like that kid. All right, I'm going to research the hell out of that kid. I'm going to look at his historical perspective. I'm going to look what he did from college and beyond. I'm going to look at what races he chose to run and where he placed in those races. I'm going to look at who his competition was in those races. I'm going to look for any gaps. I'm going to look for any suspicious activity. Like, did he improve by 30 minutes? That might mean he's not legit. That might mean he's not clean. I'm going to look to see if he has any affiliate sponsorships. I'm going to look to see what team he runs with. I'm going to look to see where he trains in the country, if it's a hot spot. I want to see teammates, past coaches. I'm going to research the heck out of this one kid. And then I'm going to multiply that by 300, because that's the care you have to give to every single athlete that you invite to participate. Part of it's risk management, and part of it is an internal drive, because you're a bit competitive and you want your race to be one of the best races in the world. And you're really pissed off if another race gets somebody you really wanted. So then you have to keep trying. You just keep trying. You just keep communicating.
Well, a couple things. I mean, the recruiting part, you know, that – Well, just the fact that recruiting was required, obviously, was something I was aware of. But the way you phrased it in terms of it also being a customer service job is very interesting as well. Talk about mm-hmm. that.
Well, it's treating other people how you would like to be treated, right? If I send you an email, you expect a reply. If I have a question, you expect an answer. If I'm the best athlete in Norway, you expect that there's going to be a significant offer for me to come to Boston. It's not just one-sided though, right? The customer service, there's expectations on our side of the fence too. You're expected to be well-trained. You're expected to show up at the starting line. You're expected to run through the finish line. You're expected not to DNF. You're expected to chase that course record. So it is customer service, but it's two-sided because we're expecting a lot from a professional athlete. We're expecting a lot from a professional field. Like, there's a code of conduct there that people have to follow. But these are amazing. Runners are amazing, aren't they? Because they're so humble. They're just humble people. They are so humble compared to every other sport. It's crazy. You can be standing next to and having a conversation over breakfast with the fastest people in the world. And they're humble, approachable, intelligent, driven, competitive, smart, witty, humorous. It runs the gamut. They're just fascinating people.
Going back to the recruiting part, you mentioned that there's all sorts of data points that you look into for each mm-hmm. athlete, and it goes way back in time. Like you might mm-hmm. be starting the process way earlier than listeners suspect.
I have more databases than anyone would ever want to know. I've read through more reports than anyone would ever want to know.
I was just going to ask you, how many, like, is there, is like, for someone working in your position, is there this one end-all be-all CRM database type structure, or do you have all sorts of disparate sources you have to go to get what you need?
I cross-reference a bunch of different places. One I really like is Telestopaga, Tilastopaga. And you can pretty much search for any athlete who's been on the books. Here, I'll do it right now. Let me see if you're there.
I probably wouldn't be. I am not someone of talent.
This group is amazing and it's international.
While you're looking it up, there's a relatively young company in our sport called Free Trail that is building out this fantasy sports type system for fans of the sport, where like if there are races coming up, they have all the top athletes that are on the starting line. You can click into each of their names and it'll show all sorts of background info.
So hold on. So this was one of my first jobs. Writing, I'm holding up for your listeners, a media guide. Wow. It's not just any media guide. It's probably about 1.5 to 2 inches thick. It covers 128 years of history. It covers all the results of those years. It covers all the top lists. And then at the back, for every invited athlete, I write a bio for each athlete. So it includes things, and some are longer than others, but it includes every single race result in the World Marathon Majors, and then historic highlights, and then personal notes. So you'll start to know things about the athletes. This is primarily for the media, but we publish it on our website so that anybody can find out anything they want to know about any of the athletes running our race. It's great.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So has it become increasingly easier for you to
do
the research portion?
Yes. So back when I started, I would be sitting at my computer because I was mainly at the beginning just writing and researching about all the athletes. So putting together all the writing and research about these athletes and then presenting it to see who was going to be invited to be in the pro fields. And I would rely on Race Results Weekly from David Monty. And the only way you found out results was from this subscription service, which would be mailed to your home. And then when everything started to go online, Runner's World was probably the first kind of data-driven experience where online they would list the most recent races. Because when you're thinking of the ultra scene, I mean, you'd have to wait till you received the copy of Ultra Running to find out the results of the Vermont 50, unless you were there in person. And then you could go and look on the side of a tree and then staple up, you know. But then there was Cool Running. I don't know. That's probably
yeah, oh, yeah, I know Cool Running. Yeah.
Cool Running was another one that you could find pretty quickly the results across the country, but you did have to look in a number of different spaces and it took time. I mean, you could read a chapter of a book by the time things came through for races. So it is easy. It's very easy.
If you get a chance, maybe after this interview, go check out fantasy.freetrail.com, which is sort of, it's one of the best beginnings that I've seen of any sort of pro athlete database. In
fantasy.freetrail?
Yes.
All right, I'm there. Thank you, podium. Oh, well, we can't bet on our races.
I don't know if we're there yet either. I'm not sure if that's a legal thing, but
that just came up today in a meeting. Yeah, there's no betting because a number of entities want to be able to offer betting on the Boston Marathon.
Okay.
Yeah. So it is allowed now? Are you just picking, like, what do you win? You're picking your...
In the case of free trail, a lot of the times there's not money on the line per se, at least yet. It's more like all the partners that are aligned with free trail, they might throw in some gear, nutrition, et cetera, shoes for people that, you know, win a particular race or win the entire season.
So it's in kind. So is this your best database?
It's one of them. Yeah. I mean, it's the one that I'm the most interested in because, you know, you can click into a particular athlete and you can see all their social handles. You can see their race history. If they've been, you know, on podcasts or featured in content in the Free Trail Network, you can go and listen to that and that'll help inform your picks.
Oh, yeah. I like that. I like the media section there.
So, and I think this is, the people behind it are super fans and they're great people. And I think at some point in time, it could take off. I think we're still at this moment in the sport where we don't have like the number of fans versus the number of participants. There's a big gap there. Like it's a very participant driven sport, as you can imagine, probably with road running too, and fewer fans. So there's that work that needs to be done. But
it's such a cozy environment. Like everybody's really into it. It's so sophisticated. Everybody knows the players, right? So you have that going for you. That's like, that's huge.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is intriguing. I'll take a look at this, go down this rabbit hole. Yeah.
Another question I want to ask you, how many of these full-time positions, like your position at Boston, how many of those exist in the road running world right now?
Well, all the majors have someone similar to myself. Berlin is also the race director, Mark Milda. And Chicago, Kerry Pinkowski is the race director, and he also does a lot of the recruiting along with Tracy Wilson. And then Sam Grotwell out of New York, myself. Ted Hayano is also the race director of Tokyo, and he does that. And then Dennis Barton Spencer Barden from London, who does London, but he also does some of the Diamond League meets, and he's great. Spencer is great. And then for a track, you know, a lot of the race directors, say like a Mark Wetmore at the New Balance, the huge meet, which is coming up in the 1st of February, he will do the recruiting. Yeah, I wouldn't know. Houston does a great job. They did a great job. They set an American record there this past weekend. Weenie Kaladi set that record on the female side. Yeah, I'm not sure. What about in your industry besides UTMB?
I think it is few and far between. I think that there are very few people out there that do it. I think in a lot of cases it is the race director themselves that is taking this on part time and sort of taking it upon themselves to personally reach out to athletes and extend invites. I think UTMB does have like a dedicated athlete coordinator. Could be wrong. I think there are some people that are hired like the week of a race or on race day to manage relations, but I don't think it's nearly as sophisticated or year round as what your job entails.
Yeah. I mean, it's not just the recruiting it's a lot about management too, because you're talking about registering athletes, waivers, contracts, shoe forms for shoe compliance, what a kit's going to look like so you can check logos to make sure they're compliant, and then lodging, flights, security, massage, all those teams that come into play, and then USADA for setting up the doping contracts, your race officials, your USATF race officials, your, I mean, there's a lot of elements. It's not just recruiting. You don't just leave it there. It can be multidimensional. So this person could not only recruit, but then they're the program manager for everything from time of arrival to departure, but everything that leads up to that, and making sure that your course is certified, that you're going to be in the record books, that you're going to be in all the databases, that you're compliant with all of the rules and regulations of the sport. Yeah, you could really get into it.
Also, thank you to Rabbit for supporting the show. Rabbit is the official apparel partner of Singletrack, and you've heard me talk about them over the past 2 months, but I have become almost an everyday user of their new Cocoon 2.0 product. It's this advanced sweatshirt with a built-in turtleneck that pulls up into a secure hood and breathable face mask. It's got thumbnails and watch windows to keep your hands warm without a fuss, and a water-resistant finish and fleecy interior for the most comfortable protection. I wear it on my runs. I wear it while ski mountaineering. It's the real deal. Winter's here, you know? So go check it out. If you need to upgrade your kit, grab one and use code SINGLETRACK20 at checkout when purchasing for 20% off your order. This is totally coincidental, but I'm reading this book about Urban Meyer, who's, if you know him, famous football coach, Ohio State, Florida, national champion. And there's this story that he tells, or that one of his colleagues tells, where they won the national championship. I think it was back in 2007. And even while the confetti was coming down on the field, Urban Meyer is sprinting back into the locker room because he knows that in that moment, he has this incredible position of leverage where he needs to hop on the phone and call these five-star recruits and say, "Do you see what just happened? We just won the national championship. I need to catch you when you're vulnerable. I want you to sign the dotted line right now. I want you to join the Florida program for next year." And I was reading that maybe 3 or 4 days ago, and I was listening to a podcast you did. And I think you kind of approach it the same way. Like, you're on the finish line of Boston, like telling Dez, like, "Let's do this thing again next year. Let's run it back."
Yeah. Yeah. I have signed people the same day for the next year. Yeah, definitely. And it's more for Boston anyway, it's more a legacy issue that we love our champions and we want to provide that platform for them. And it's more a respect for that athlete. But you also, you know, there's going to be athletes that come in that are devastated, and you have to really take into consideration the whole person. Yes, is it a business? Yes, to some extent. But also, these are human beings, runners, and there's going to be more people disappointed than happy for any race, you know, because everybody goes into that believing that they will win, that they will podium, that they will PB, that they will get something out of this race. But the reality is that more often than not, because of the temperament and personality of a competitive professional athlete, they might be beating themselves up as well about that performance and have to take some time, take a breath, take some time and reevaluate and learn from that experience. So we do like to offer, you know, I mean, Sisay Lema, he's the fourth fastest human of all time over the marathon distance, and he will run Boston. Well, he's already run Boston twice in 2017 and 2019, and he did not do well. I think he came in 30th in one of the races. He did not do well. But did he learn from that experience? Yes. Are we inviting him back because he has tremendous potential and we believe in him? Yes, absolutely. I always knew Des Linden would win from the time I met her in Chicago when she ran one of her first marathons. I think it was 2010. Because you can kind of see the fit, especially for Boston. You know what I mean? Is that person going to prevail? what is it about that personality and talking to that person? Are they going to prevail? So you really, beyond the paper, you get to know these athletes when they arrive on race week. We usually have them arrive, you know, Thursday for the Monday race. And you do get to know their personalities and what drives them and ask them those questions, because beyond the paper and the research and the stats and the results, something in your personality is going to also inform you how you're going to perform.
When you think about like your year-round priorities in your job, like the parts of the year that are more focused on the customer service component, the parts that are focused on recruitment, how does it break down, like spring, summer, winter, fall? Like, are there things you're doing in each of those seasons? Is it a blend? How does it work out for you?
Yeah, it's a blend. So right now we've announced the fields for the marathon, but right now I'm recruiting for the 5K and the pro mile, which is the Saturday before the marathon. So as soon as that gets finished, which might be in a couple of weeks, and then I'm obviously waiting till after the U.S. Olympic trials, because we might add in a few more Americans. But I'm also already thinking about the 10K in June. And then after the 10K in June, we have the half in November. But in between all that, I'm also taking trips to do recruitment for the 2025 Boston Marathon. So I wouldn't say there's ever really a downtime, because if there is any time, then I'm working on other projects. Right now I'm going to be doing competition committee, bringing in together experts in the industry to elevate our understanding of competition in this sport, in this marathon world. And where is that competition driving excellence, and where is it hindering excellence? And what are the technical aspects we have to be cognizant of, whether it's equipment, shoes, nutrition, doping, what are those elements? So trying to bring a work group together to really dive into that deep. So those are the side projects that go beside recruiting, which is continuous because there's always communication, and then the actual feet on the ground race week experience, where you set up, you know, we set up something similar to like an Olympic Village in downtown Boston for these athletes.
For those like focus group activities, how soon can change be affected? Like how quickly can you get some sort of decision on a particular area of the competition that you're concerned with? And like, how quick is that timeline?
We're in a very fortunate position to have a lot of leverage for it to be quick actions as necessary. I mean, we're working right now introducing, we have now 7 divisions in the para group. You know, that's one of our growth areas. And 7 divisions is unheard of. We're the first race in the entire country to offer prize awards for para athletes. We were the first to offer prize awards for wheelchair athletes. So it depends where, what avenue you need to make change in, what's the front burner, what's the back burner, and then you just go from there. But when you can get enough decision making makers in the room and you have that leverage, you can approach World Para Athletics, you can approach World Athletics, you can approach the top governing bodies of your sport and say, why do you not recognize the 5K as an event for para athletes? What is making the 5K on the roads different than the 5K on the track? How can we help you help us to get this as a certified event? Because it's only going to raise the profile of the sport. So you pick and choose what you can change, and then you go from there.
I want to talk a little bit about sort of what goes into recruiting each athlete and what you're able to offer. I know, of course, we can't talk exact numbers, but like when you think about each tier of athletes that you deal with in the recruitment process, and you think about what they're getting, like money, travel, accommodations, gifts, what does it generally look like? Like when you're thinking about that top tier, maybe for example, like what can you offer? Like what can you pick from in your sort of like bag of tools to offer them, to incentivize them to come?
Well, Boston has its challenges, and here are the challenges. It's not a flat and fast course. We don't have pacemakers.
Yep.
It's not world record eligible. It is world best eligible. You still get rankings and points, similar to what you do in the trail scene, with World Athletics. So you are a ranked athlete. Having said that, and it's a challenging course. People say it's a net downhill. It is, but there's also a lot of uphill. And the uphills come at a very unfortunate time, about 20 miles in, when you've kind of lost your steam. Having said all that, and we have a lot of competition in the spring. As you know, we have Tokyo, London, Paris. There's a lot of racing that goes on in the spring, and a lot of racing in Asia particularly as well. So to incentivize athletes to come here, we do rely on that history, which is great, but we also, that world-class experience is very important to us. So we try to be better. We try to be the best at what we do. So that's in the comfort level, the welcoming atmosphere, the staffing. We have an incredible staff at the BAA. We have, I think it was like one volunteer for every three people in the race. We have a great set of volunteers that will do anything these pros need to do. We have a chef at the Fairmont Copley who prepares all their meals for them. So they have a communal dining area. So for the top athletes, you look at their experiences and their accolades and their successes and their potential. That's the first thing you do. And then for that top athlete, you assess a value. They're also ranked according to World Athletics. We're a platinum label World Athletic event, which means I have to have a number of platinum athletes in the race. Those would be like ranked number 1 through 30. And then I have to have a number of gold athletes in the race. That's also another parameter. So I'm looking at a finite budget that has to be dispersed. And at Boston, we not only like quality, but we like depth of field too. So that is not just like you'll see some races and there'll be 10 guys and that's it. And then there's drop off, drop off, drop off. And then there'll be three guys. You never know the outcome of a race. But if you have, in our case, I think we have 20 women under 223. If you have that body of talent together, you are creating a more compelling race. So you look at what depth you want to achieve and the quality, and then you take your budget, and then people are awarded accordingly to their accomplishments. So if you're an Olympian, if you're an Olympic medalist, if you're a world champion, if you're a world championship medalist, if you've won a major, if you are a 22-time NCAA All-American champion, Edward Cheserek, you're awarded accordingly. But your time and successes are what drive the appearance fee. We also have a very deep prize award. It's over $1 million now. So that's also an incentive for Boston. Travel, lodging, meals. We always try to allow an athlete to bring a plus one who is paid for. If an athlete has a small child, they're always welcome, because I'm a mother of four and I'm a grandmother of two. So we like to take care of those babies. And just little touches where we can. A training trip. We've had a lot of the Americans come out for a training trip and we'll pay for that. And then they get in my car. I drive them out to Hopkinton and the coach and I will shadow them and bring them hydration and feed them.
I'm not sure exactly how to phrase this question, but like, obviously there's certain athletes who are very hot right now. Like they've just had this amazing series of performances in the last 1 to 2 years. Obviously they deserve immediate consideration for this pool of athletes. There are also athletes that have a legacy of high performance, but for whatever reason in the last, like, let's call it anywhere from 2 to 5 years, they haven't been at that level. And so how long does that latter pool of athletes stay in consideration for, you know, receiving appearance fees and being catered to for the race and stuff like that, and why?
Yeah, I mean, you're looking at the body of work, right? Because there are interruptions, obviously, for female athletes. There could be pregnancies. For male and female athletes, there could be injuries. So you are acknowledging interruptions in the career. You are also acknowledging the length of a career. You're never discounting, though, talent. Edna Kiplagat just ran a 67-minute half marathon in Houston at 44 years old. So Should she be rewarded? Yes, absolutely. She's a two-time Boston champion. Should she be rewarded? Yes. Do we have to think about longevity and diminishing performances? Yes. But you're really looking at the body of work. But for the pro dev, that's people, you know, ranked 30 to 60 in the field. You're trying to afford the people who have had performances, really great performances in the last 18 months or 2 years, a little bit of an edge over someone who might have PB'd, run a 210 in 2019. So you want to award those pro dev people who are up and coming, who are performing. I just got that inquiry actually from a Kenyan coach because I did not take one of his athletes who was slightly better than one of the athletes I did take. But what he didn't take into consideration was his athlete, that performance was now 4 years old, and the athlete I did take was 1 year old. But the athlete I did take had so many more accomplishments overall in comparison, despite the close time. So it's not just one thing. So when coaches come up and would say to a recruiter, but my guy's faster. Yes, your guy did perform faster, but your guy also ran a 230, a 245, and a 250 in the same year. This kid might have run 208, but he has also done X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
But you do have to be transparent, and you do have to have a reason for everybody on that starting line, because there are going to be people that you turn away, and there has to be a reason you turn them away as well.
I'm also curious about the race week and the race day experience, and for context on the trail running side of things, with few exceptions, we're still at this point in the sport where the elite athletes walk to the same start line in concert with sort of the age groupers and stuff like that. They exit the race when they finish in the same way with like little numbers of handlers, if any, around them. Throughout the race at aid stations, it's typically, you know, loved ones, family, maybe local area fans helping them out, but it's fairly underwhelming in that sense. Like you, except for the fact that they're at the front of the race, you couldn't really tell that they're different than anybody else in the race. Can you contrast that with maybe the way elites at Boston are treated in the lead up and like how they're like, you know, maybe bussed to the start line or whatever, and how they're taken away and who handles them throughout the race?
Yeah. And I think one of the differences that just kind of came to me when you were saying that, I mean, I love that about trail running, is that you feel like you are running the same race as everybody else and having the same accoutrement, so to speak, as everybody else. What I think drives that, though, is that for the pro field at a race like Boston, is that, let's just take personal hydration for an example. You can't afford someone, there can't be any unfair advantage. You know what I mean? So everybody has to, I can't be there handing my husband a special treat at mile 72 because he's my husband, and then next to him, the person doesn't get a peanut butter and jelly sandwich because I'm not related to him, right? So there's a little bit of a difference there. But the difference, it's not very big, because everyone has to get bussed out to Hopkinton. So in Boston, you're all bussed out there. You get seated according to your time. And the pros do start separate and early because we can control that. And the reason for the separate start for the men and the women, for the women, they know who they're competing against. So it's not a mixed race. It's women against women. So they can see their competitors. And the men, the same way, they can see the men. But by having a separate start, you can also control any issues that may come up in rules and regulations. We can't test everybody in the open field, although when you sign for any race, you are subject to random drug testing for any race that is USATF certified or World Athletic certified. But we can control vetting each of those athletes so we can look at their history and understand if there's been any infractions in the past. So that's why part of the reason we have the separate start. Other is obviously media value, so that the media can cover those athletes as well. But as far as transportation, one thing that is really, really cool is that we stage them all in downtown Boston, and we have four buses. They could really fit on two, but if one bus breaks down, we need to then get them to three. And if two buses break down, we need to get them to two. So we think of everything. So we have four buses, everybody's spread out, but the stadies on motorcycles will lead us out to the Mass Pike, which is the main thoroughfare going out to the race start for your listeners. And they actually close down the highway and escort the pros out to the start. And it's very quick, and it's just an amazing thing, especially if you've ever driven in Boston, to be escorted by the state troopers out to the starting line. So that's really cool. And then we're at a tent outdoors on the Hopkinton Common, but it is covered. The masses are also staged at a school, and they have some covering and tents as well. So not too much of an advantage there. But, you know, for the pros, there is a call out for media. They get to wave. You get to see those stars out there. Mm.
If you were a race director in the trail running world and you had little to no budget, so things were extremely tight and you had to be pretty crafty about this whole process, mm-hmm. how would you approach it? Like, what are some things that are, again, like in your skill set or your toolkit, irrespective of budget, that you can deploy to get a really strong field at your race?
I have been in that situation before, but I would leverage setting, opportunity, prize awards, other awards, anything you can get from sponsors. I mean, let's just go way back. I would host the Turkey Trot for the Marshall Youth Roadrunner kids, any kid in town. I went to probably about seven different supermarkets, and for each one, I said, I need 20 turkeys. I'm putting on this race, I need 20 turkeys. Well, by the end of the day, every single kid who showed up at that turkey trot got a turkey. And then I would repurpose trophies, recycle trophies, put them back together, get a new placard that said, 3-year-old champion of the 20 whatever turkey trot. They would get a trophy if they podiumed. So at any size race, you can always approach people for, I mean, who doesn't love some swag? I mean, we were listening yesterday, Tarzan Allison Brown's granddaughter came to visit the BA offices, and she was talking about he went to the 1936 Olympics. He won Boston, the second Native American to win Boston. And, one of his prizes was a bathrobe. He won a marathon and got a bathrobe. What did he do with the bathrobe? Well, he put it on. He wore it to the awards ceremony. He got a second bathrobe. He gave it to his wife when he came home. I mean, there's always something that can incentivize someone to run. But if the race is intriguing enough and challenging enough and has enough spark to it, wouldn't you as a trail runner want to run it? I mean, there are people who are 212, 213, 210 marathoners who are coming to run Boston because they want to run Boston. There are masters runners who are, let's see, one of my fastest master runners is coming from, where is he coming from? Slovakia. He's a 215 guy. He's coming because he wants to run Boston. We have it pretty, I mean, there is that factor, that X factor from Boston. But for other races, I think you have to just build that X factor. You know what I mean? I mean, why would you want to run the Vermont 100? You get to slug through the mud up and down Mount Ascutney, cross like rivers. Like, why do you want to do that?
I wouldn't want to do it. So I have a hard time answering that question, but I know that there is a really good answer out there. I'm sure that there are multiple people.
I mean, it's a hard sport, right? A lot of people are paying to get their way here to run this race. I mean, I have had athletes say, you know, it's just too expensive to find a hotel room in Boston. I can't run this race. And it's like a 228 woman, you know, it's really, it's harsh. It's a harsh sport. Yeah. As far as the funding goes.
I got to ask you one more sort of X's and O's question. because we've spent a lot of time, you know, giving race directors a sense of what they could do, how they could be empowered in the situation. How about for athletes? Do you have any advice to athletes on how they can or should?
Just ask.
Just ask.
If you need something, just ask. Because if you don't ask and you're just on the sidelines complaining about it, you'll never know. Just ask. Hey, can you accommodate me in this way? Just ask, because if you don't ask, we don't know. I mean, I've run down to Marathon Sports to buy a pair of shoes because someone didn't have the right shoes. Just ask. You know, we will try our best to accommodate you.
All right. Turning towards this year's Boston, I know in the past you've said that, like, when you're building these fields, it's not just about quality. It's about, you want this exciting depth of field where, you know, it's not certain that the best in the field are going to win this thing. And do you feel like you've accomplished that with this year's men's and women's fields?
I do. I will be honest with you. I was a little bit nervous going into this year because it's an Olympic year. And I was getting a little bit of rumors going around that, you know, some of the East African runners who are very talented, because they were waiting on Olympic selection, because sometimes what Kenya and Ethiopia will do is they say, well, we're going to name 10 athletes, and this is going to be our Olympic prospect team. Well, what they're doing is they're telling those 10 athletes that they need to hold on till almost the summertime and possibly perform again in the spring to be in consideration. So that means you might get some people diverting to flat and fast and paced marathons to. Everybody has hope, right? All runners have hope. All runners think they are going to make that Olympic team. That element of hope is what keeps you getting out the door every day. So I thought it was going to be challenging, which it was. I had to work a bit harder in Olympic years, obviously, because you don't have the star power of those top Americans and some of the other notables, because they're either skipping over a spring marathon to run the Olympics because they already know their spot is secured, or they have to go to another race to get that Olympic standard to be considered for their country's team. Having said that, you just keep working. And I mean, even the morning of our men's announcement, I had added a two-time Olympian from the UK. So you never stop working. You never stop.
The last second.
Last second, you never stop trying. But it continues up until, you know, once we start to ask for travel plans, because we will book their travel, the people who don't sign that travel form right away, then you're thinking, okay, something's going wrong with training. They might be a little nicked up. They know they have a few more weeks. I'm going to keep an eye on that person, and I'm going to nag them a little bit to fill out the form. But if the form doesn't get filled out by the second deadline, then we really have to talk about it and see what's happening. Last year, Helen Obiri, who won our race, phenomenal athlete, world champion, medalist, Olympic, two-time Olympian, she was basically on a waiting list because the budget was spent, the field was full, but I got a drop at the last minute, Sharon Locati, who had won New York. So a little bit of the budget freed up, and I said, hey, Helen, if you want to get in here, and she told her coach, Jathan Ritzenhine, who's also an American Olympian, I don't want to run Boston. The field's too deep. There's too many talented women. And Jathan, who has run and performed well in Boston, said, no, you need to run Boston. And thankfully she ran Boston. She's one of the few women to double at both Boston and New York, which she did this past year. So it's tough working on it. And then the decision with the U.S. trials, because a lot of the U.S. runners want us to double, but you can't take the risk as a recruiter to have this large contingent of Americans that you're spending budget on when they have to run a marathon 7 weeks before your race. So in a lot of the contracts, we will have a clause that says you can't run a marathon 90 to 60 days before Boston or 90 to 60 days after Boston, because we're not just looking for the athletes who want to pay out. We want the focus to be Boston. So we're not going to have you allowed to make an income from, say, Paris or Tokyo and then come to Boston and run here, because we know you will not be focused and you will not be at your full fitness. So the decision for Boston was, obviously, Des had to come back as a champion, and she wanted to double in 2020 before the Olympics, before the pandemic. That was canceled. So we knew she could double, and plus she's the 50K record holder, so we know she has that grit in her. And then Emma Bates was back on track, but was injured for too injured to prep for the trial, so she's on the list. So that gives me two women. So on the men's side, I'm like, who are the top two men that I know can handle a double? Well, an obvious is CJ Albertson, who just set a 50K record, and he ran Sacramento, and then 1 week later got the Olympic standard, and his time differential was like 10 seconds difference. It was absolutely phenomenal. That kid is kind of like a Yuki Kawauchi. So we went two men, two women. On the men's side, also Matt McDonald. He's a BA high performance kid. He's very smart too. He's a doctoral student at MIT. He came in 10th in Boston in a really deep field. So we knew he could handle it because he lives here and he knows the course. So having said that, I went deep on different countries and fast. It's the fastest women's field ever recorded. And then the men's side, similar. It's all online. You can look at the names. You can, if anyone's interested in names, you can just go on BAA.org and you can find the field release and the names there. But it is crazy because when you do this recruiting, it's really interesting because in Boston, you may have to look like 20 deep and then you find someone like who won New York or someone who won an Olympic medal. So it's not just the times, it's what their accomplishments are. Seldom is the person with the fastest time, seldom do they win Boston. I think it's only happened once or twice. Meb was like 14th on the list or something like that when he won.
Well, two things. One, that freshness clause is so interesting. And I'm not sure that that exists in our sport, although I think it would make a lot of sense for a lot of different races to require that athletes are showing up to the line, well-rested at the end of a continuous training block. It's really interesting to do that. But I'm guessing because there's a relatively large amount of money on the line that you're investing in them, it makes sense from that as like an insurance policy in a sense.
Yeah. I mean, there are a number of those kind of clauses and every race does different. Some incentivize with the time bonus, some incentivize with a DNF reduction or a time reduction. So recruiters and race directors can also use that, and that extends your budget because then say you had $100 to spend for your budget, you can go up to 125 because you know that overage will be returned to you with time deductions or DNSs or DNFs.
One of the last questions I want to ask you is just sort of about like the environment we're operating in. And you kind of talked about this earlier, but it seems like your biggest challenge isn't competing against a particular race, but it's this culture, like you said, where it's you have the latest shoes, the latest coaching, the latest nutrition, the pacer assistance, and that creates this super strong allure to run as fast as possible.
Yes.
And when you're competing against that environment, I'm curious, are you seeing that like the average age of the top competitors is getting older because they're waiting longer into their careers to do Boston? Or are you finding that this is less about the interest in running fast and it's sort of like a war of convincing people that like they like both options, but I can convince them to do Boston instead of running necessarily on this like super fast course? Like, how do you think about that?
Yeah, that's definitely intriguing. Boston can be a very fast course, as you know. I mean, from some of the past racing here, we had that 203.02 from Jeffrey Mutai way back. But this need to go fast is intriguing to me, especially in this Olympic lead up, because Paris is going to be a rolling hilly course. And it's going to be a championship style. There's no pacing. It's rolling. So do you want to mimic that at least once in your career before you go there? I mean, even if you took Kipchoge as an example, we wanted him to be ready for Boston. And we wanted him to want to come to Boston. Mm. And we wanted him to get the goals. You know, he wanted to break two. That was the goal. Like, what are these athletes' goals? We always take that into consideration. We want them to come to Boston because they're ready to run Boston and because they want to run Boston. Yeah.
I know that Boston area people, because I'm from the area, I know Boston area fans are exceptionally educated about this race and the competitive fields. But beyond that, I'm sure you think about this a bit. Like, what are your thoughts on how to present the race so that you're simultaneously educating and you're creating more fans for this elite part of the sport? Because it's something that we're struggling with in trail where...
I think all of running struggles with it. Do you know what I mean? Can you name who won the Olympics, the Olympic marathon, the female? Which female won the Olympic marathon in Tokyo? I know the answer.
I just know Molly Seidel got the bronze a couple years back.
Yes, good job. Perez Jepchichir won. But it is, it's a constant battle to storytell. And yeah, the Boston fans do know, it is really kind of phenomenal to go out on that course and see people running there all the time and yelling out names of people I bring to train there, which is awesome. But there's also a lot of track meets in Boston now too, especially indoors. It's kind of become a focal point for indoor running, especially at BU, and some of the records that are being set, and at the New Balance track, So yeah, and they're always packed. The stands are packed with people just coming to watch these phenomenal races. Maybe that's part of it too. Like, is our country, is the only focal point one city and state for these amazing performances? I don't know what the answer is. Yeah. Maybe it's just, if you're interested, then you're interested.
Yeah. It's amazing that in like the 1880s and the 1890s, pedestrianism was so popular. And there was like, I guess because maybe betting was involved, going back to betting. But
That's true.
Anyways, yeah. Mary Kate, this has been incredible. I've learned a ton. I'm sure the audience has as well. Do you have any final calls to action or thoughts before we go?
No, I'm just like so happy for your audience. I love ultra running so much, and what a great experience it is. And you have some great top performers and inspirational, and it's just such a great sport. Love it. Running is... it's just part of who you are. Makes people happy. Keep up the good work, everybody.